Thanks for listening to the podcast from Faith Radio Mornings.
Start your day connecting faith to life with Faith Radio Mornings.
Let it rise.
Good morning, everybody. 4 minutes after the hour. We just had a very interesting conversation with Dr. Rosemary Stein. We didn't even get to half the stuff we wanted to. A caller just called in and said, how do you improve a toddler's attention span? That would have been a good question for her because she is very, very smart. And the other thing we wanted to talk to her about was toxic stress that kids are experiencing right now. And there's a great deal of talk right now about the ongoing negative effects that are in our homes. And it's largely in part to the political climate. And the other stress that is wreaking havoc on kids is poverty. So that's something that is just sad. It's sad that there's a difficult situation for kids that are living in poverty, that that's causing a lot of stress in their lives. And I can see that. It's just sad. And what are we going to do about it? I don't know. What are we going to do about it, Rebecca?
Well, oh, are you asking me to solve the problems of the world in 30 seconds?
That would be helpful.
Well, I wish I had those kind of answers and that kind of power. But I think the first step is to become aware of it and to have our hearts softened to the problems that we see around us. And I also think sometimes it's easier to focus on what's going on outside our own homes. And maybe that's sort of the attraction to technology, to always being on social media. It's like everything's going on out there. But that can cause a distraction when we seek to connect to and to face up to what's going on in our very own homes, the closest to us, whether it's our spouses or our kids or those in your life. And I think God has intentionally placed us where we are for exactly for a reason and to use the skills that he's placed in us.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's our first responsibility, and that maybe sometimes the wider world has a lot of problems and that distracts us from our main mission, which is right in front of us.
Well, I think parenting is just hard, period. And then you put all the stresses of the world in and everything that life is offering, and it just makes it very, very hard.
So. Right, which requires, I think, the focus, like that laser focus that says, okay, what is my main mission here? And then there are other good things that you can do, but is it that first priority? And it's got to make the main thing the main thing. It's tough.
Yeah, and we are running out of the month. It's the February 24th today, is
yes,
that right?
Yes, sir. And when According to my calendar.
Okay, and you know this is Black History Month?
It is.
Yeah, so we're going to talk to Jamar Tisby after the break here. And then we're also going to talk to Chris Martin today, the millennial evangelical. And there are lots of interesting news items that are coming up. So stay tuned. Don't go anywhere. I hope your Friday's off to a good start. I hope you're feeling good. I hope you had a good night's sleep. And I'm just so glad you tuned into us this morning. Hopefully you're getting some good information, some news, and some spiritual inspiration. That's what we try to do every day here at Faith Radio. All right. Bill Arnold here. I'll take a short break. Be right back. Minutes after the hour. Good morning. Do you know that it is Black History Month? And Jamar Tisby is a Notre Dame grad. He's president and co-founder of the Reformed African American Network, where he blogs about theology, race, and culture. Very smart, very articulate, and well thought out work. Jamar, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Excited to join y'all and talk about these important topics.
I agree. Where are you calling from this morning?
Okay, so I'm on the road quite a bit this month, and so I am calling from Princeton, New Jersey.
Okay.
Doing a couple of Black History Month talks here, but my home is in the Mississippi Delta on the Arkansas side.
Yeah.
That's usually where I am.
Mm-hmm. My guess was this was a very busy month for you.
You got that right.
Yeah.
Very busy, but in a great way. I love talking about race and history and theology, so the more I can do it, the better. It would be great to spend more time with family, though, so I'll be looking forward to things slowing down a bit after February.
Mm-hmm. So what are you going to be talking about today that you can talk about this morning on the show?
Sure. Well, this is a couple of talks that I've done. So last night I did a talk at a campus ministry called Truth Thursday, which is specifically geared toward African-American and Afrocentric expressions of Christianity. And we just did a Q&A, and I had a lot of fun with it because those are the times when, you know, what folks are really thinking can come out and they can ask the awkward questions, and it's sort of a safe space to do that. Tonight I'm doing something a little different. It's a talk on leadership from Joshua chapter 1, when Yahweh commissions Joshua to take over after Moses dies. And so I'll be talking about that and being strong and courageous as leaders, which, by the way, those are traits that come in really handy if you're doing work with racial reconciliation.
Yeah. Jamar, what was one of the awkward questions from last night?
well, there were several good ones. I think a lot of the questions focus around when African Americans are trying to help their white brothers and sisters understand their experience of race and racism from a minority perspective. And a lot of times they get pushback or deflection. And so many of the questions were centered around, what do I do when it seems like someone isn't listening? So, you know, there are a lot of different ways to respond to that. But one, I mean, start with the Bible. It's very logical and straightforward as Christians. But, you know, the Bible talks often about being one body and being united in the spirit. And so the Bible says if one part of the body suffers, all suffer. And so even if there's some sort of objection or misunderstanding in terms of what racism is and how it plays out, when you look at another believer and they're telling you they're hurting, then as part of the body, you hurt too. And so there's that empathy, there's that solidarity. And the Bible also says, weep with those who weep. And so you see someone else who is going through a very difficult experience, and whether you can relate to that from your personal experience or not, you can still weep with those who weep. And so I just encourage us to remember our unity in the body, and no matter what kind of different perspectives we're coming from, we can still see someone in pain and relate to that person as an image bearer of God.
See, I never say stuff this smart. Jamar, I want to talk a little bit about the Black Lives Matter movement. How do we understand the heart cry of this movement?
Well, the Black Lives Matter movement is a very controversial movement among Christians because, just to be honest, if you go to their website and you look at their platforms, there are some things that Christians would strongly disagree with, particularly about marriage and family and gender, things around those kinds of ethics and identity questions. However, I think for many Christians, if you start there, you've actually short-circuited the empathy process. Because what we have to understand first is that Black Lives Matter as a movement is coming out of certain circumstances and experiences that Christians ought to be able to understand. And so Black Lives Matter in particular comes out of the moment when George Zimmerman is acquitted from killing Trayvon Martin back in 2012. So the murder was in the killing was in 2012, and then in 2013 is when the verdict came back. And it was in response to that verdict that many African Americans were feeling this sense of pain, the sense of injustice, and a woman, one of the founders of Black Lives Matter before it ever became a thing, just basically wrote a letter on Facebook to black people and said, you matter. And then her friend picked it up and said, Black Lives Matter. And so I don't think there's anything controversial about that, that there was a sense of pain and a sense of injustice and a sense that as people of African descent in this country, we don't matter. And then this is an affirming statement. This actually, Black Lives Matter as a statement, affirms the image of God in people of African descent. It's also a lament. It's a crying out, how long, Lord? How long will we endure injustice and pain like this related to race? And so in terms of the principle, Black Lives Matter, I think Christians can and ought to demonstrate some understanding. In terms of the actual program and the platform, we can have some very important and legitimate different points of view on that.
I'm talking to Jamar Tisby, the smartest guy in the room right now. Jamar, let's talk about racial reconciliation when we come back. I want to ask from an individual level, how does that best work? So that's what I'm going to ask when we come back. It's 15 minutes after the hour. We'll take a little break and be right back. Seventeen minutes after the hour, having a very interesting conversation with Jamar Tisby. And Jamar, right before we went to break, I asked you this question. On an individual level, how do we best do racial reconciliation? Because we hear that a lot, and I think, okay, what is me, one guy? How does it work best? What do I do?
Well, I would actually encourage us to think on two levels as far as racial reconciliation. One is the individual level, but the other level is also the systemic and institutional level. So one of the books I often recommend for folks to read as they're beginning to wade into this issue of racial reconciliation in the church is a book called Divided by Faith by Michael Emerson and Christian Smith. Now, it's a sociological analysis of why the church is divided along racial lines in the first place. It sort of diagnoses the problem, which is important because we often want to jump to the solution before fully understanding the problem. One of the issues that makes racial reconciliation in the church so hard is that we tend to only understand racism on an individual level.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, racism is defined by someone calling someone else the N-word, mm-hmm. or not liking someone because of their skin, and that's it. Therefore, the solution then is purely individual. Well, I'm nice to people of a different race, or I went out and had coffee with someone, so I'm doing my part to dismantle racism. Well, that is necessary, but not sufficient. The way that race has worked out in this country is it's actually embedded in the everyday practices of life, whether schools or bank loans or real estate. And so you don't actually need an individual animus towards someone else for racism to continue to function. So what we need to do is work on two levels. One, we need to cultivate relationships with people who are different. And this is important, especially for folks in the majority, because a lot of times that systemic and institutional aspect of racism is invisible. It's something they haven't experienced before, so it's very hard to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not until you can put a name and a face and a voice to those kinds of pains and that kind of discrimination that the transformation begins. And so on an individual level, what can one do? You know, it starts around the dinner table. Who are you actually inviting into your home? A lot of times we want to look at Sunday morning and say, hey, we should be integrated. Well, how can we expect for our Sunday morning worship to be integrated if we don't live integrated lives?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it begins.
Mm-hmm. You just made the daily highlight reel with that comment.
Great.
Let's talk about
it's a truth I hope we live out more and more.
And it was so well expressed and articulated. I just appreciate that. Let's talk about the five reasons that we might celebrate Black History Month. give me five.
You don't want me to recall them all off the top of my head, do you?
No, because I have to be out of here at 8.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, understand that Black History Month came out of an attempt to address a deficiency in U.S. history. Because understand, for a very long time, African Americans weren't allowed to read or write, let alone write the history
mm-hmm.
of their experience or the experience in the United States. And so Carter G. Woodson, a long time ago, said, let's do Negro History Week in order to highlight the contributions of African Americans to U.S. history. And so this is a fundamental understanding, I think, that comes with Black History Month, which is that Black history is American history.
Mm-hmm.
It's not simply a subset or off to the side. It is actually part of the American story, but historically, the contributions of people of African descent have not been highlighted, have not been promoted. And so Gerald Ford signed into law Black History Month, and so we have an entire month to celebrate the contributions of a distinct set of Americans who, under very difficult circumstances, namely slavery and Jim Crow segregation, continued to contribute positively to this nation. And so that's one of the reasons why we need to highlight those contributions during Black History Month.
Mm-hmm. Again, another great answer. Tell me about your family. I'm just curious as to how you grew up and what it was like for you growing up. And I'm just real curious about your upbringing.
Well, I became a Christian in high school through the ministry of the white evangelical youth group. And I am eternally indebted to my pastor and to the other members of the group for introducing me to Christ and setting me on this path. However, I knew very early on that I was a minority in a majority white setting, which was fine. I was loved well. At the same time, I still longed for some more cultural footholds, if you will. And that persisted throughout college. A friend of mine sent me a book by John Piper, which called Desiring God, which sort of introduced me to the theologically reformed branch of Christianity, which I really resonated with. And it was more of the same, where I was a racial minority in predominantly white churches and schools. And along the way, really what arose out of a personal desire for culturally inclusive community turned into different ministries like the Reformed African American Network and the African American Leadership Initiative at Reformed Theological Seminary in Jackson. And so all of these are really attempts for the church to be the church, which means everyone has a place, everyone has a voice. And by the Holy Spirit's leading and prompting, we've been able to help forge communities and connect people, and I'm excited that this work continues.
What's coming out of Washington, D.C. that is most frightening to the African-American community?
It is the normalization and even promotion of exclusion, if I can put it in a word. There seems to be a kind of attitude or stance or disposition that really arises out of fear of people or situations who are different. Now, I know a lot of folks listening to this will immediately think about the very justified claims about safety and making sure that we live in a country that has safe borders, safe cities, things of that nature. I get it. I understand. But we need to do that in a compassionate way. And what I hope that Christians who are white or Republican understand is that there's a real sense of anxiety from people who are vulnerable in this society, whether refugees or immigrants or African Americans or women. And as believers, before we are citizens of this earth, we are citizens of the heavenly kingdom. And so our heavenly citizenship should inform our earthly citizenship. That is to say, what Jesus teaches about compassion and empathy and solidarity ought to still be in the equation as we make political decisions. And so can we protect and do everything we can to be safe without further marginalizing people who historically have been more vulnerable in our culture. And so those are some of the things that are on my mind and that I hear as I travel and speak around the country.
Jamar Tisby, founder and president of the Reformed African American Network. Are you looking for a vice president? I'd like to send my resume.
We're looking for all the help we can get, but really, you know, most of our submissions on the blog post, randnetwork.org, come from guest contributors. So if you have an idea about race, theology, culture, and you don't have to be African-American, we have contributors from all over the racial and ethnic spectrum, email us at submit@randnetwork.org, submit@randnetwork.org.
That's awesome. And Jamar, pace yourself this month. Don't burn out, all right? We need you.
Thank you, sir.
All right,
thanks.
Have a great day. You bet. It's 26 minutes after the hour. We'll take a little break. Be right back. Good morning. I hope your day is starting on the right foot. Get in touch with the Lord. Pray about your day. Tell him what you need. Trust in him. All right, that's all you got to do. We're going to hear more from millennial Chris Martin when we come back. Stay tuned. As Christians, we are called to serve others and live unselfishly. Here's Pastor Carter Conlon.
There's many people who just come to the cross, but they want the blessings and benefits of the cross, but they don't want where the cross is calling each of us to. And ultimately, I am called to live for the benefit of others. I'm not called to live for myself. Now, God will bless me, and He has. But I'm called to live for others. I'm called to give my life as a living sacrifice, as the Scripture asks us to, which tells us it's our reasonable service. And if that's not in its proper focus, then if I gravitated to a gospel and a message that's just all about myself, then I'm going to become fearful. I'm going to be shaken by the days ahead when my retirement plan might collapse and when the things that I thought my life were going to be don't materialize. But if I'm living, as Paul was, for the benefit of others, then I'm not shaken by the days that I'm in right now.
Find the full message from Pastor Carter Conlon at myfaithradio.com. Take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Chris Martin, the millennial evangelical. Be right back.
Adam was a good kid who came from a Christian home. But when he transformed into a disrespectful, dishonest, and rebellious teen, his parents turned to me for help. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. When I sat down to talk with Adam, this is what he told me. He was only allowed to watch G-rated movies. He couldn't wear T-shirts with any insignia of any kind. He couldn't go out during the week unless it was for church. He was only allowed to listen to Christian music. And this kid was 17 years old. Now, Adam's parents had good intentions. They followed their protective instincts. But their rigid boundaries actually drove their son to rebellion. Are you trying to shield your teen from danger? Train him for the world in which he'll live, not the world you wish he could live in.
For more great tips from Mark Gregston, go to ParentingTodaysTeens.org. ParentingTodaysTeens.org.
Minutes after the hour, Chris Martin is a writer, a thinker, Chicago Cubs fan, and not in that order. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, man. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, this is kind of a deja vu moment. I used to talk to you, and now I'm back talking to you again.
Yeah, it's here we are again. It's nice to be chatting with you again, man. It's fun.
Yeah, I'm like the Lionel Hutz of Faith Radio here.
If I was older than 26, I might know what that means.
Oh, that's hilarious. You never watched The Simpsons. You never watched The Simpsons, huh?
No, I didn't. I think that's one of the shows my parents weren't cool with me watching.
Okay.
But now that I've seen a few episodes,
I know.
My mom's listening, so sorry, Mom. It's not really that awful, but whatever.
All right. Let's talk about some of the things that are going on with Facebook. I know that Mark Zuckerberg, who's a fairly rich guy, is kind of looking for trying to learn what churches are doing.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. There was this big, like, I call it a manifesto. That's what a lot of people call it. That maybe sounds more like malicious or like manipulative or something than it really is. But this past week, or I guess almost 2 weeks ago now, Mark Zuckerberg published over 5,000 word note on the future of Facebook. And it was called Building a Global Community, and just kind of his idea of what the future of Facebook looked like. And I work in social media for a living. My job is to help authors better reach their readers on blogs and social media. Mm-hmm. And so I'm always interested. I want to be the first to know what Facebook's doing and why it's doing it and what changes that may have and all of that sort of thing, just so I can be informed and help my authors. So when Mark Zuckerberg posted this, I was kind of right on it and started reading it and kind of annotating it mentally and physically in some sense with creating this blog. And it was really fascinating. And one of the things that came out actually in a recent interview with Mark Zuckerberg and was kind of in the article but not explicitly mentioned was that Facebook wants to look like Saddleback Church, which is kind of funny. I mean, that's Rick Warren's mega church in Southern California,
mm-hmm.
For anyone who's unaware. And you hear that and you're like, wait a second, like, isn't Silicon Valley defined by like secular humanism and like futuristic stuff? And it tends to be kind of seen as a godless place. So why does it want to look like one of the largest evangelical megachurches in the world? And that's a good question to ask. And really what it comes down to is that not that Zuckerberg wants Facebook to adopt the faith of Saddleback Church per se, but if you think about Saddleback, it's this massive church with multiple campuses and is really kind of a well-oiled machine that's been running for all these years. And he would really like Facebook to figure out how to do community like Saddleback does. You know, it's Saddleback is one entity that's made up of a ton of people. But within that, there are a bunch of little communities in which people can gather together and relate to each other and serve each other and be active in community with one another. And he kind of sees Facebook that way. I think he would kind of like to learn from what Rick Warren and his team have done there over the years.
So his goal at Facebook in this manifesto, if I understand this right, is to be a structure to try to connect people offline as much as online.
Correct. Yeah, which is kind of cool.
It's very
because
cool.
a lot of times one of the knocks that has always come to social media is like, well, you know, like it's just a parallel universe. Like we're just going to sit around on our computers or our phones all day and not pay attention to each other, and it's like kind of distant from real life. Mm-hmm. Like it's not the same. Whereas Zuckerberg's goal, his ideal future of Facebook, and really, as I write in the article, like, this guy's the godfather of social media. He didn't create it, but social media as we know it today, he kind of determines where everything goes, and people tend to follow him. Mm-hmm. And if people innovate around him, he just buys them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you always, when he speaks up about social media or the future of Facebook, you really want to listen. So I think it's great that he wants to integrate our digital virtual lives on Facebook with real life. Because I think it'll maybe erase that line where sometimes it feels like people can be one kind of person on Facebook but a different kind of person in real life. Now, we're all sinners, and that's going to continue to be the case no matter what advances Facebook makes. So we're still going to maybe act one way one place and a different way another place. But I think it's cool that Facebook's goal is not just to get people connected to old high school friends or whatever online. It has bigger goals than that, and goals that it hopes can benefit society and help us better serve each other and live in community with one another.
Mm-hmm. And they do want to actively work at improving just the online discourse. I mean, you're right. They don't want to just help you connect to a high school friend, but he is interested in having it be a platform for activism, but he does want to keep people safe. And so he's trying to put it all together, isn't he?
Yeah. It's, you know, Facebook, one of the points that I make, because it's one of the points he makes in his piece, is that Facebook wants to actively work to improve our online discourse. And I think it's kind of funny because Facebook's kind of to blame in part for our online discourse becoming how it is. Now, again, we're to blame, just like you can't blame Doritos for the obesity epidemic. You can't blame Facebook wholly for our poor online discourse and how we've kind of become nasty to each other. But I think Facebook has kind of made it easier, and social media in general has made it easier to be nasty to each other and has kind of hindered discourse. But Zuckerberg writes, social media is a short form medium where resonant messages get amplified many times. And here's the key point. This rewards simplicity. At its best, this focuses messages and exposes people to different ideas. But at its worst, it oversimplifies topics and pushes us toward extremes. Mm-hmm. And I mean, goodness sakes, if you can – I mean, that is exactly right. And if that's not been clear in the last year and a half, I don't know where you've been. So something that has always bothered me about social media is how it discourages nuance. And that's why as I've gotten older and perhaps wiser, I've tried to engage in fewer and fewer arguments. And even if they're good natured arguments on social media with friends, because it's just, especially on Twitter where you have a character limit, it's so hard to fully explain some complex issue you're debating. Right. And it's usually better off just saying, hey, let's talk about this offline and then getting coffee about it or something like that.
Right. Chris, there is every single religious group has increased its reputation among Americans except for one. All right, we're going to talk about that when we return. 45 minutes after the hour, more with Chris Martin in just a minute. Forty-seven minutes after the hour, Bill Arnold here talking to Chris Martin, the millennial evangelical. And Chris, right before we went to break, I was looking at this Pew Research data, if you will. It was talking about how Americans feel about various religions and how those feelings have changed from 2014 to 2017. And here was the most interesting part of this data, and it was the focal point, in my opinion, that asking the question, every religious group increased its reputation among Americans except for one. You fill in the answer.
Evangelical Christians.
Ding, 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 ding. You're the winner.
Yes. So over the course of the last 3 or 4 years, every faith group that Pew surveyed, this is Muslims, Mormons, Hindus, Buddhists, Jews, Catholics, mainline Protestants, and atheists, increased in their reputation, or as they put it, Americans' warm feeling toward a particular religious group. Every group improved over the course of the last 3 or 4 years, except evangelicals,
mm-hmm.
which is concerning, I think. I think it's important to say up front, some people may listen and say, well, that's okay. We're not supposed to live in the fear of man and looking for the approval of man, but looking for the approval of God. So forget what people think about us. That doesn't matter. I think it's tempting to think that. But I think when we see things like this, we shouldn't freak out. We should ask our question, though, why? Mm-hmm. We should ask ourselves the question why. I write at the end of this piece, after kind of getting wonky on some numbers and all that, I say evangelicals have a PR problem. It could be nothing more than that, but it certainly isn't less than that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's fair to say that evangelicals could be the nicest people in the world, and we may still be hated by Americans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in 100 years from now, if things get worse for evangelicals in the United States and hostilities grow even more, and restrictions on faith grow, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
we could be the sweetest people in the world and still be hated by our neighbors just mm-hmm. because they know what we stand for and they don't like that. So I think it's important to say that. But I think it is interesting to point out that everyone has grown America has grown in acceptance of everybody except evangelicals. And that's, I think that's problematic.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think is causing the primary thing that's causing this complication?
It's hard. Pew doesn't ask the question, well, if you don't feel warmer about this particular faith, why is that?
Mm-hmm.
I wish they did. That'd be a lot more complicated and I'm sure expensive survey for them. But that would give us maybe a little bit more qualitative data on that front.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I kind of write in my piece, I say this. I think when it comes to Americans not feeling warmer about evangelicals than they did 3 years ago, the overwhelming support, evangelical support of Donald Trump must be considered as the central reason for this phenomenon. That's not me making a statement about Donald Trump or if evangelicals should or should not have supported him. But without a doubt, no matter what you think about him, everyone can agree he was a rather polarizing and divisive figure. Still is a rather polarizing and divisive figure, but especially over the course of the last 3 years and perhaps even the last year and a half. Because of the overwhelming support of evangelicals for Donald Trump, I think it's fair to say, I think I wrote in the piece, it would be silly to ignore that as a possible factor. Obviously, we can't point to that as the only factor or maybe even the primary factor. I think logic can point us that way, but there's no data that points to that. But I definitely do think it would be silly to ignore that as a primary or if not focal factor in why evangelicals' support among Americans has not grown over the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that millennials are having a little bit of a harder time affirming the values that Scripture has forever laid down? And either that, or,
I think,
or they're ending up going to churches that are focused more on the experience than on biblical truth?
I think it's hard to say millennials are doing blank in
okay.
that scenario.
Okay,
because I think you have Anecdotally, I mean, I know a ton of, you know, I go to a church that just happens to, my wife and I recently moved to a new town within the last, it's almost been a year now. And our church is largely made up of millennials all over the spectrum from youngest to oldest. I think most of the people in our church are millennials. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I do have a lot of unbelieving millennial friends. What we do know from other Pew data that they're the primary provider of millennial data and their stuff is great. What we do know is that while millennials are by and large not religious, a lot of millennials would say they're not religious. We do know that a lot of millennials are spiritual, mm-hmm. and they're concerned about spiritual things. So this idea that, you know, millennials only believe in whatever the scientific method can prove to them and things like that, I think is misguided. I think mm-hmm. that's wrong. I think they perhaps put a larger weight and value into scientific method and naturalistic ideas than maybe generations that came beforehand. But Pew has a number of data sets that I don't have in front of me that show that millennials have an idea. Millennials believe there's something beyond the physical world. They're just not sure what it is, which is why they don't call themselves religious, because they don't know necessarily that a particular faith system has correctly put their finger on that.
Mm-hmm.
They're interested in what lies beyond in our universe. They a significant percentage, I want to say it's between half and three quarters, but it might be closer to half of millennials have a quote sense of wonder about the universe.
Mm.
And I think that is a more spiritual feeling, not just like they wonder what the mass of the nearest star is or whatever, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I think, are millennials rejecting the truths of the gospel that have been proclaimed throughout millennia? Yeah. Just like any other generation has.
Yeah.
I don't think it's fair to say that they're more godless. I think it is fair to say they're less attached to institutions, the church being included. But I think millennials are not in a spot where, oh man, they're just a bunch of godless people who have no interest in spiritual matters. That's not the case. I think millennials may be an irreligious people who have an interest in spiritual matters, but they haven't quite decided how that manifests itself in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think perhaps it could be easier to evangelize and share the gospel to millennials for that reason, because they're at least interested in spiritual things. They're not shut off to that beyond which they can sense with their five senses, if mm-hmm. that makes sense.
It does make sense. Now, the millennials, largely at your church, do you feel like you have a lot of social justice motivation going on in your church?
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. I think so, but not in the early 2000s or 90s sort of social gospel feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have moved beyond that a little bit. Not to say that there aren't churches around that perhaps sacrifice the gospel on behalf of social justice issues. That's always going to be the case. But I think millennials do tend to be very activist oriented.
Mm-hmm.
They have a lack of trust in institutions. That includes the church. The Great Recession happened in our most developmental years. September 11th happened in some of our most developmental years. So we have a lack of trust in institutions,
mm-hmm.
which is going to lead us to want to work on behalf of others even more, because perhaps we don't trust institutions that in the past may be known for helping people to help people any longer.
Mm-hmm.
So I think maybe some of the bad things that have happened in our lives have led us to want to live out this more activist lifestyle, whether that's a part of a church doing missions or not a part of a church just doing more nonprofit work.
Yeah. Well, Chris, thank you so much. I'm sorry I ratted you out for watching an episode of The Simpsons to your mother. I apologize for that.
Oh, no.
I'll send her a note. I'll send her a note. That'll make things up.
That's great.
All right. Thanks. Have a great weekend. It's 56 minutes after the hour. We'll be back in just a minute. Fifty-seven minutes after the hour. Thanks for being with us today. I saw on the news that there is a restaurant in Las Vegas at the Mandalay Bay Casino Resort Hotel. It's a $5,000 hamburger. Wagyu beef and some foie gras. Did I say that right, Rebecca?
Foie gras?
Foie gras, yeah. And it's got some some French black truffles. And for $5,000, they will make up a burger for you. I think I'd be most encouraged for the waitress who carries over a hamburger from the kitchen to your table and could be obligated for a 15% tip.
I'm thinking, what is the tip?
$750 to carry a hamburger to a table.
My goodness.
Sign me up for that job.
Better like the burger.
I feel lucky that we might be avoiding the big snowstorm here in the Twin Cities area. I don't know where you're today, but I hope the weather is nice, and I hope you have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us this week. Bill Arnold in studio today. I'll be here next week as well. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to this Faith Radio Mornings podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support. You can make your gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Faith Radio Mornings, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or on your podcast player. And thanks for sharing the audio link with a friend and growing the impact of Faith Radio Mornings.